everybody. My name is Nancy. I'm an alcoholic. And, hey, you stayed up. Good for you. If you go to sleep, I'm going to call you at 2 in the morning. I have 3 drinks up here. 2 doubles and a water Beck. So. I want to thank you for being here. I guess you say it's the gopher state, but because you're here, it's the go for it state. I want to thank Denise, of course, for her patience and her persistence, and she's just a great, great chair. And also Anne for looking out for me. I appreciate that a lot. And I came tumbling down the runway yesterday, texting like a teenager, and Ann caught me and said, "Over here, we're going here." Okay. So anyway, I've kind of discovered texting lately. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic of the the garden variety, and I love being able to share what's happened to me. I loved what I heard tonight, that our experience is our treasure, and that's what I have to share. That's all I can tell you. And you know, it's funny, because as you go along and you remember things and you see them differently, maybe it comes out different. I don't know. There's a writer named Tim O'Brien, and he makes a distinguishes between story truth and happening truth. And I know all you experts on truth will like this. Happening truth is what happens. And story truth is, well, it's something else. Here's an example. This is happening truth. An alcoholic is around, gets sober, and dies. That's happening truth. Oh, wait. An alcoholic is around, gets sober, wills his body to science, and dies. That's a happening truth. Story truth is this. An alcoholic is around, gets sober, dies. They cut up the body parts, and the scientist puts the brain in a vat of alcohol and turns away and suddenly hears, "Ah." That's story truth. You get it, didn't you? Didn't you get that one? That's the gift that we share. You know, there's something about us that is just, well, I'm preaching to the choir because you're here, and that's good, you know. But it's a great obsession of every abnormal drinker that somehow, someday, and that's been a part of my story. I can't stand here and tell you that since I've been sober, I've never thought of a drink. I have. I've thought of getting drunk because that's what I like best. But I haven't done it by the grace of God and your incredible help, your incredible lives that you share and the honesty and the love and all the story truth. All the story truth. So anyway, I'm a Southern California native, and I'm the only native in my family. My mom and dad drove out to California from Pennsylvania back in the late 40s. You know, picture this. I'm kind of romantic about history and stuff, and so I'm trying to share a little bit of that with you. But they drove out here with 2 little girls in the back seat, my oldest sisters. And my dad was a hotshot writer. He had a big job on the in California that they were driving to, because he had a byline on the LA Times, and it was in the late 40s and the early 50s. And they got a home going in Glendale, California that was, you know, right up there, upper middle class home, and it was full of life. And my dad's writing, and the other people from the paper, and other writers and politicals, and of course the Irish Catholic. Hey, even the bishop came just to hang out. And there was music in the house and little girls, and I was born, and they would tell me with all the love in the world, they'd say, "You were not planned." They would say, "We were really hoping for a boy, and we chose your name was Michael." Now, my mother loved me more than anyone has ever loved me, I'm sure. And so she never said it to me that way, that I'm just kind of playing with you a little bit. But that was what I would hear. Because I was born with those 10-foot antenna, you know, that just senses everything, senses the truth out there. And I was born responsible because everything was my fault. I just knew it. In fact, I was an alcoholic in the womb. Here's my evidence, Your Honor. Here's my evidence. My mom carried me for 10 months. I was like stuck in there. And because I didn't want to come out. You know, I think I had my little fins pressed up against the uterine wall going, "No, I don't want to be born. It's going to be bad." And then I was born and I'm a victim. That's story truth. But you know what? That's the way I felt about it. That's the way I felt when it was. And so I'm born and I'm in this little house and there's music and writers and play, and it's the American dream in 1951, and my dad died on a kitchen floor one morning. And so everything changed. The feelings in the house changed dramatically. And my mom was this tough, great Irish woman, and she had these three little girls. It was 1951. And they, you know, in 1951, there wasn't that much support for single women or single parents. And my mom's sisters back in Pennsylvania said, "We'll each take a girl." And my mom said, "No, I'm going to keep them together." And she sold that big house and moved into a little duplex on Glendale Avenue. Moved all the little three little girls in one side and rented out the other side and kept us together. And that was where I grew up. And there were feelings in that house. There was feelings in the house. And when you're little like that and you have 10-foot antenna and you didn't want to be born, you know it's your fault. And I remember the oldest feeling in my life was that things were my fault and that it was my job to fix it or to make things right. I don't know what I thought, but that was the way it was. There was just pain in the corners of the house. And you know what? I discovered that I could help a little bit because I was a singer. I started singing when I was 5 years old. And for some reason, I thought that helped. I thought that helped. It seemed like when I sang, it cheered my mom up. I don't know why, but that was the best I could do. I was being a little singer. I was being a good girl, going to Catholic school, trying to do the right thing, trying to make it better, always looking for, you know, stuff to cheer my mom up and so on down the line. And I was a geeky little kid. My sisters were older, and they were cute. My sisters were hot. They were cute. They buzzed around, and I was a little geek hanging around behind them. I had buck teeth. My ears stuck out. I was goofy, but I could sing. When I was 10 years old, my mom got my ears fixed. I was the first kid to have plastic surgery and just pinned those ears back. My ears won't move. They're stuck. But my mom was worried about my ears, and I was worried about my mom. And I had, you know, I was just bumping along trying to be good, and I got good grades, but I could sing, right? My mom met a man who had a ranch in Washington, and he was a widower, and he had a couple kids, and I thought, oh boy, now we'll be a family. This is going to fix these feelings. And I was happy for my mom. And she decided one day that we would go to Washington and live for a month in that town with that man and see if they could really, really do it, if they could really, really make that family, big family. And so we took the train to Washington, and we were on that train, and I was attacked on that train and molested when I was 12 years old. And I couldn't tell my mom because But I didn't want to add that to her cup. Her cup was full. Her plate was full. I didn't want to bring one more problem to my mom. And so I kept that inside of me with all those amazing swirl of bad feelings of guilt and shame, and it was my fault, and why did I attract trouble wherever I went? And I kept that inside, and once I started drinking on top of that, it never saw the light of day till I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was no good, I was trouble. You know, it just, that was what I brought in here. Anyway, when I got to be about 13 years old, the anger was building and building and building because I had all these feelings and there was nowhere to put all this stuff and I didn't know what to do about anything and there was no one to talk to. And that's when I picked up that drink in the bathroom at Catholic school at that famous age in AA, 13, you know, and that was a good drink. That was a great drink, man. Oh, relief. At last, went right to the care center, and all that had gone before didn't matter. And I got tough. I got something to work with. And that's what alcohol was. It was something to work with. I remember having that drink, and there was an actress called Loretta Young years ago, and she used to have a TV show where she burst through these French doors and the music played and she was it. She was on top of the world. And when I drank alcohol, I remember that feeling. I'm just like Loretta Young, man. I'm it. I can burst through the door. And it was the first drink that did that. Right away, I felt great. And then we were in the bathroom at Catholic school, that little cement lavatory with the little sinks. And I was changed. And the bell rang, we went back to religion class, and I turned my will and my life over to that moment, to whatever that was. And the next year I was in public school, and I was working on my image, and I was trying to be a bad girl. I was never a bad girl. I was a pseudo bad girl. Well, I didn't really want to get hurt, but you know, they had these girls in East L.A. who were bad, and they ratted their hair tall, and they put razor blades in it, and I liked it. I wanted to be, so I'd rat it really tall and just sort of sans razor blades, no razor blades, just tall hair, and big black eye makeup and white lipstick, and the beatniks were on their way out, and the hippies were on their way in, and it was something. And I was like, I was so into this now, I just quit everything decent and good that I could, and I became an instant juvenile delinquent because of that drink, because of the life I attached to it. You know, whenever I see a 13-year-old or 12-year-old all decorated and pierced, and I get this feeling in me, it's just this incredible moment. It's like empathy, twang, something. I know that, and I want to go there. I want to reach back to me, and I want to change it. But in AA, I don't have to do that. These things are our assets, yes? So anyway, I went on, and I got into public school, and I became a thief. I used to steal, and statute of limitations on that. And I fancied myself some kind of Robin Hood, because I had some kind of weird liberal interpretation of where I was in this world. And you know, but Robin Hood was a good guy. He stole from the rich and gave to the poor, and I just stole from department stores, and it stayed here. But somehow there was justice, and I couldn't figure out what the justice was, but that was the crazy thinking that we have, and that I had, and that I brought to you. And the greatest discovery I made when I was 14 years old were the coffee houses in Hollywood. I was living in Glendale, which was a little redneck burg at the time. I discovered the coffee houses in Hollywood in the mid-60s, and these were beatnik joints, really, just turning into this something else, right along with the rest of the culture. And I loved the fever. I loved the ambiance. I loved the coffee houses. We were in there singing this great music, and it seemed to me that I was just born for that, because all that protest music, man, you know, in the 60s, I love that. I'm a hippie still. I love that protest, defiance. I love that. I didn't know really what was wrong, but I it was so true. I'd been cheated, and I just didn't know what it was. So whatever they said was wrong, I got in the parade, and no, I did finally learn about the 60s in 1987. I took a class. Good class. It was called America in the 60s. Cal State Fullerton. And they had all these, you know, textbooks. It's really exciting. And, you know, we went to the moon. God, geez, no kidding. Civil rights? Really? Women's rights? Come on. It was just like really a moment. And everyone in school was the right age for being there. And they all looked at me and they said, well, you were there. I said, would you like to go for coffee? So, anyway, it was... Being in that fever, in that rush, it was a great time, and the culture was shifting dramatically, and the music was reflecting this, and we were with the birds, getting 8 miles high, and whoa, Bob Dylan was plugging in his guitar, and oh my God, and these musicians were starting to just come along, and there was so much discovery, and it was beautiful, and I loved that, and my school just went away. I missed so much school, and it didn't matter. I got great grades in music, and that was all. Everything else was D-stops, and, you know, I didn't care. I was already living the life of a young alcoholic. I didn't even know those words. I just knew that I was in this, caught up in this fever of change, and I loved it. And I saw my first therapist when I was 15 years old, and she meant nothing to me. And I almost died when I was 15 years old. I was invited out by this handsome man who was a football team guy, the captain. I guess they have captains in football, right? Yeah. Oh, sorry. Anyway, it's connected to music at the time. Anyway, he invited me out on this double date, and we went to the drive-in movie. You know, when you go to the drive-in movie and you're 15 and there's tequila, and he revealed his innermost self to me. I said, wait, give me that tequila. And I just drank, I chugged like the whole bottle, and the next thing you know, they're dragging me to my mother's porch and dropping me off on the back porch, and she drags me into the house, my Irish mother, and calls the doctor, and they talk on the phone, and the doctor says, she's dying from alcohol poisoning. There's only one thing you can do, Mrs. Newman, she said. Give her coffee enemas, and my mom gave me coffee enemas all night long. I like coffee, man. Come on. But here's what I want to share with you. The next day, I didn't die, right? The next day, no one talked about this. In my house, no one talked about this. I didn't say anything. She didn't say anything. And I just kept going to Hollywood and going to those coffee houses and singing that music and meeting these strange people. Oh, man, the characters. I was 15 years old. When I see a child today, it's amazing. I want to reach back. I want to do something. But now I share. And so I finally reached the end of high school, and I met a band. I was in this coffee house, and I met this band, and they were crazy, man. They were so much more than just three guitars and a drummer. They were new. This was this miracle, this discovery, this thing we were finding. Music is so beautiful because I didn't have language. I didn't know right living anymore because I had started pouring alcohol on what I knew before, and I didn't have language, but music could go where words can't even go. Music was a healer. It was my connection to God. So I loved music. I was passionate about it. Loved listening, loved performing. So I went into this coffee house one night, and I met this great band. They were so different from everybody else because they played everything. I mean, they played everything. They had bongos and a cello. Hippies had never seen a cello. And when we put a pickup on the cello and we set him down in front, all the hippies lined up, grazing their consciousness down for, oh, oh, the cello. He do a glissando, woo, everybody go, oh my God. A million epiphanies. And they played everything. They had bongos, they had the cello, they had congas, they had a violin, they had a regular bass player, they had a drummer, they had a paraplegic in the wheelchair who played the cymbals. He didn't play them on time and nobody cared. Do you see what I'm saying? And they had this, and you know us, I heard this, I saw this. Oh, the other thing, the seeing, they were like a mini United Nations. This was before the word multicultural had even been coined. And every human color. And I had to get in on this, man. And I stood up in the middle of the room and I started to sing this old song from the cotton fields, this old black song from the cotton fields. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. And I sang and I sang and I sang. And they just did a riff, GC, GC, back and forth, and all the sounds and the flute, and we were just caught up in this, man, that was what I liked to do on a Tuesday night. I loved it. That's how I lived. And I broke away from them. Actually, we gigged once. They were called Jay Walker and the Pedestrians. The best we could do then. And there were 26 of them. So it was really hard to stop and start. We just played the key of go. You know, you go, go. Take a solo, okay. So anyway, we were innately doomed. And so I got out of high school with this. I got a scholarship to CalArts, and it meant nothing to me. Because I was already on the outside. I was ready for you and didn't even know it. And it wasn't even going to get here for 11 more years. But I had met them. And they 8 of us broke away from Jay Walker, and we set up in the keyboard player's parents' home. And this is where my story, where God is and the angels are just kind of around me now. And this little house was in Silver Lake. And Alex's parents are Italians, little Italians in Silver Lake from the old country. Like the old country, the repair shop and the house, they're all one. They're together. So you walk up to the house, and over the front gate are big red letters, Anthony's TV and Lawnmower Repair Shop. And you walk in, and it's a shop. It's a repair shop. There's TVs everywhere with dust and every condition, and radios, every kind of radio, and bicycles and tricycles and roller skates, and a cat in the corner having kittens all the time. And and in the other corner is a guy named Kelly with a soldering gun in his hand and a cigarette right here. A guy never moved for 13 years. He got picked up once for drinking and driving, so he quit driving. Yeah. And then you walk into the next room, and it's this little sunny yellow kitchen. And it's the families in there, the family. And they have one wall full of pictures of the kids and ribbons and mementos and picnics and Fido and Kitty and calendars and where we're going and ticket stubs. And it's floor to ceiling like that in there. And Ann and Anthony are little short Italian people, and they look up at me and they say, oh, she's so beautiful. And I could sing. And I felt this family take me in like this. And it was about the music and about the love and that warm kitchen. And there was always coffee on the stove and there was always wine on the table. And it was a neighborhood central. Everybody came there. And we put all the young musicians in the next room, this little tiny living room with big amplifiers, you know, those old fashioned amplifiers, big ones, and full drum set and electric piano and the cello's in there and guys are crammed in there. And it was so great. And it was hot. And it was the summer of love. And it was, and we wrote these sets. And we bonded. We wrote 3 45-minute sets. And then that October, instead of going to college like everyone else, we opened for Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company at the Whiskey A Go-Go. And we called ourselves Sweetwater. And man, we were an overnight hit. I mean, we went whoosh. And it was so exciting. It was about timing. It was about things that happen sometimes. And this was a happening. And inside of me was this mass of everything I've told you about now, it lives down here. And I pour alcohol on it so that I can laugh. And I pour alcohol on it so that I don't care. And that's how I live. And then I sing. And I sing real good. And I sing these old blues songs. And I sing nice new songs. And I sing Sweetwater songs. And I keep that alcohol, keep all that stuff down here. And that alcohol is working most of the time. And so then we started flying around the country, and we played with all the major stars of rock and roll, and we played all the rock rooms, and we played all these big rock festivals. And inside of me, this thing that's in there is there, and there's another thing. There's this crazy, what do I do with all this stuff? Because I was afraid. On the one hand, I felt arrogant, like I proved to everybody who'd ever been mean to me, no, you missed out on the rock star. But at the same time, I felt you were going to find out I was no good. You were going to find out about this big ball inside. You were going to find out I killed my dad, because that's how I felt. You were going to find out. It's crazy, isn't it? It's just us. It's crazy. I didn't know anything about the middle till I got here. Thank God you've given me the middle. Thank God I have better ideas today. And I don't live like that. I don't feel like that anymore. So we're taking off. We're going up, 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 up. We are almost rock stars. We are ready. The next thing is going to be our turn. And so we opened up at Woodstock. We were the first band to take the stage at Woodstock. 4 months after Woodstock, on a rainy December night, 3 days after we had taped the Red Skelton Show, which was early MTV. Okay? I was on my way to watch a performance we did on the Steve Allen Show. And I was on this freeway. I had a girlfriend with me. And I got on the freeway. It had been rainy all night. The streets were slick. You couldn't get through. There was no open lane. So I stopped my car and I said to my friend, phew, we made it. And right after I said it, I got hit by a drunk, man. That, not like that. It was really big. So I was squashed. My car was demolished. It went spinning across in the rain, and I went straight up into the roof of that Buick Steel. I made a crater the shape of my head in that Buick Steel. No seatbelt. Boom. And I went over. Nothing happened to my friend. She got out, started wandering around in the rain, and there just happened to be one off-duty nurse from the fender benders who found my friend, one police on the scene, one ambulance. That nurse looked at me and said, this girl's really in trouble. She's got to go. They put me into the ambulance. When they shut the door, I went into grand mal seizures from this massive blow to my head. They took me to Glendale Memorial Hospital on the one night of the month when all the neurologists in Southern California were having a meeting. All the head guys. They all worked on me. And they all said, this girl will not live. No one can survive a blow like that. Well, you and I know there's a power greater than all the neurologists in Southern California. And check it out. I think they're all dead. Meanwhile, the band was waiting for me back at Alex's house to watch that show, and then the phone rang and everybody came. And the whole Irish family came, and I was supposed to die, and I didn't die. And they said, well, she lives, she'll be a vegetable, but I came out of that coma, and I knew who Tricky Dick was, and I could add 13 and 4, something I can't do now, but I could do it then. And I had brain damage, and I had brain damage for the next 12 years. And so I had like brain damage squared when I got to AA. I did. I came in with a broken head from this car accident, and they told me that I was going to have to see a neurologist for the rest of my life. There was no way to fix that. There was no operation. There was no cure. It was going to be like that for the rest of my life. I had petty mal seizures. I had word turnarounds. I stuttered sometimes. Sometimes I just didn't know where I was, just a little bit. And so I kept going to the neurologist in my sobriety, my early sobriety. You know, I got to be 6 years sober, and I was visiting with him, and he was asking me the same old routine, and he just put his pencil down. He said, you know what? He said, you don't have to come back here anymore. Your brain's healed. Isn't that nice? I have not been troubled by car accident brain damage for 26 years. And that's a miracle. Thank you. That's a miracle of our way of life, of our design for living, which really works. Just a little physical miracle. Don't we get used to them? There's just a lot of them around here, huh? Just a lot of them around here, huh? But if you're new, hear this newcomer. And if you have something that they've told you, that's a done deal, man. That's never, we don't know. We just stay in the chair and we do what we do, and things can change. We don't know. I'm just very grateful for that. I also permanently lost the use of one of my vocal cords, and I had to learn how to talk again. I had to learn how to sing again. But you know, I was when it this all happened, and I realized that I couldn't speak. I had four notes, and they were very soft notes, and I had to whisper everything. I had six operations on my throat, and but I had the tools of a. The tools of a crazy person, because I didn't believe it. I did not believe it. Nah. You could not have taken any. That was the only thing I lived for. I had to sing. It was all I was good at. It was the only way to really handle the ball inside of me. It was the only way to take care of myself and take care of my mom. Nah, I had to sing. That's all. It's craziness. And so I didn't believe anybody. And I worked. And they operated on my throat six times. And I studied with a coach. And he taught me some things. We trained the other cord to do the work of two. Brilliant guy. And I went to see another voice doctor, and he said, "Well, you'll never sing opera." Well, who wants to? So, and the band was devastated, but I didn't care. I lived on Planet Nancy. You know what I mean. I lived on Planet Nancy, and I felt sorry for them, but I didn't care. We were the almost rock stars. I'm telling you, all our friends were getting these big hits of the 60s. We were next, man. We were next, man. It's like standing at a turnstile, and you're next. You're supposed to go through next, and then they drop the gate. All these guys go through. It wasn't until I got sober that I realized that all alcoholics are almost people. Ain't no big thing. We're all almost get the job, almost keep the house, almost keep the spouse. We're all almost people, man. We're fighters and we're survivors, and it's a miracle that we ever give all that up. So anyway, I was working real hard on this voice thing. Eventually, the band broke up, and I moved into Hollywood. And I tried to be hip, slick, and cool, but I just always make mistakes. My punchlines are a little bit off, and whatever. I finally got a new record deal on my own, and I had developed a style. It's kind of hoarse. They used to say, "She doesn't sing notes; she sings chords." That's pretty cool in the 60s, man. 70s. I was one of the first five females to ever sing lead in a rock band, you know, and I'm the only one that really cares about that, but sure. So I got my own record deal, and I was trying to be a singer-songwriter, you know, and be famous, and that album came out, but this alcoholism was not going to wait around for me to get totally famous, and it was having its way with me, and things were bad. I was having a lot of problems. You know, the typical thing that everybody has, no matter what you do for a living, if you're an alcoholic, pretty soon you worry about those blackouts, and you worry about those crazy people that you're hanging out with, and you're trying new ways to make it last longer, make it feel better. You don't understand why you're getting sick, or how you're getting sick. All that stuff started happening to me, and I switched to wine and kind of left the hard stuff behind and tried to live differently, joined a health club for a while. And then that record deal folded, and that record company went away, and my personality started, I started really having a lot of trouble, and so I needed some Valium to sort of help. And then I needed, I had Dexedrine, I took Dexedrine every day, that's speed. And I had my Valium and some sleeping things and my wine, and I made a few phone calls, You know, and nobody wanted me to play for them like they used to. And I, you know, in my personality was getting weird. And I thought, well, I'm not going to put a band together anymore. And I'm a guy who played the bass. And I started playing my own keyboards. And this guy played the bass and smoked a lot of pot. So he really couldn't talk. He just made a lot of mistakes, you know. They were low, and that was okay. He looked good. He was skinny. He had big hair. And but nobody really wanted me to play. And yet... And yet I was starting to find out. You know, there's a definition of hitting bottom that goes like this. It says, hitting bottom is when you lose the only thing you care about as much or more than you care about drinking. And this was my bottom, was losing music. And I was losing music. I would have lost my mind if I could have held on to my music. It was losing the music. I was losing the music. I couldn't believe it. And I couldn't understand it. My brain wouldn't work. And the phone didn't ring. So I was worried about my image. So I got a secretary. Hey, people with secretaries are important, aren't they? There's something going on. Why would you have a secretary? So... this woman drank like I drank. Perfect. So we get together and we go to these famous places in Hollywood and we drink and talk about they and them and how I was coming back any day. She actually had a business, a pretty successful little business, and I said, if we put a phone in your office and if it rings, just say my name, okay? That was my secretary. So anyway... she got sick one day, and I thought she ought to join my health club, and instead she called the next day and said she'd gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I said, you're fired. And I didn't really know what Alcoholics Anonymous was, but it didn't sound very hip. It's a bulky, cumbersome term, in my opinion, and I just didn't sound hip, and I could tell things were going bad for her, so I wanted to get away from her. And I was still struggling, and I started living in a series of tomorrows. When you're living in tomorrow, and you're me, and you're up there, and your music is slipping away, and no one is in your life, no one cares about you because you pushed everybody out. You start living in tomorrow, and when you live in tomorrow, you say, well, tomorrow I'm going to make that phone call. Tomorrow I'm going to write a song. Tomorrow I'm going to go meet with that right guy. Tomorrow I'm going to get it together. And you mean it, you say it with all your heart, you even plan it, you make a plan, you make notes, and then you can't do it. And then it keeps going from one tomorrow to the next tomorrow to the next tomorrow. And that was what happened to the rock star. Just nothing, man. I'm just nothing. I'm living in nothing but what these dreams, resentments, fears. I've been cheated. And I ran around with two guys who were gay guys. Well, now, I really liked them. They were drug addicts and they were gay guys. So they didn't want to have sex with me. They didn't drink my wine and they cleaned my house. My life was pitifully stupid. It really was stupid. But I didn't know it. I thought I was the great I am. I didn't know it. I ran into this ex-secretary. I was terrible. The drinking was terrible. I could be full of alcohol and not be drunk. Do you remember those days? Do you remember that? Drinking, and you're not drunk? Oh my gosh, that's terrible. Or you have two drinks of crappy little white wine and you get smashed. How stupid is that? How embarrassing. And there's no control. What's going to happen? I had this fine car. I'd abandon it with the engines running, the doors open in Hollywood. It's like I was out of my mind most of the time. But I didn't know it. You know, the crazy you are. Anyway. So I ran into this ex-secretary at a Hollywood party. My only life was really simple. I had one prayer. Just don't let me fall down while the sun is up. You just want to stay in a vertical position during the day. Is that too much to ask? Life was real simple. I also quit smoking pot. I haven't had pot since then. No one cares about that either. Something, I want a chip or something. But I thought one night I was drunk. I looked at my pot box and I said, you know what? That's bad for me. Anyway, I kept drinking. So now I just don't want to fall down when the sun is up. And I run into my former secretary, that Judas, whatever her name was. And God puts one of those big warm smiles into my path. And she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her, drinking and talking, and she's smoking. She'd been going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and she didn't drink anymore. But she took Quaaludes and smoked pot. And she thought, AA is really wonderful, man. And it is really wonderful. And now I have more sobriety than she does. But in this funny Sunday afternoon comic Hollywood moment, God smiled into my life. And he did a miracle with my friend. And she had seen the signs on the wall that said, "We carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffered." And I was, oh, people, I was so bad. I was a young woman, but I was, alcohol was beating me up. I was fat. I was sweaty, my eyes were empty, my heart was shriveling, and I'm just standing there trying not to fall down and be cool. So she looked at me, and she'd been going to AA meetings, and she saw the 12 steps, so she took a hit on a joint and said, "You ought to try AA." Yeah. And she added, "It's heavy." "It's heavy" was a vernacular to attract me into it, I suppose. Because, that's the way we used to talk. "It's heavy, man." So anyway, I thought, what a bad deal she was. I was glad she was gone. Because I was horrified. I couldn't imagine coming to AA and smoking pot. What a boring. All I was doing was living in my tomorrows, knowing that I was going to get it together tomorrow. Music was coming back. I was going to be all right. Everything was going to be good. I had a plan. So I bumped around the world a little bit more, and I called AA once, and the woman answered, but she talked too much. She didn't listen to the great I am, and I bumped around the world a little bit more, and I got a black eye, and I got a split lip, and one Sunday I woke up, and I was fat, and I was sweaty, I had a black eye and a split lip, and a broken heart, and my hand tried to run away. My left hand took off. Jeez, I never had a body part do that before. It just took off, man. It wanted a divorce, was trying to fly out the window behind me in my little kitchen. I'm making coffee, and my hand's trying to go away. That's not working. Freeze frame, right? And God smiled into my world one more time and sent me a postcard. Little message. "Why don't you call AA again?" So the great I am reached for the phone, and because there was no one else to call, couldn't call a doctor, couldn't call my mom, couldn't call my sisters. They wanted no part of me. Couldn't call a man. Didn't have a man. Didn't have anybody. Didn't have a girlfriend. Hadn't had a girlfriend since high school. Didn't have anybody. Just had people that you shuck and jive and drink with, you know. Didn't have anybody. So I called AA again, the great I am. And here's that selfishness and self-centered planet Nancy. They answer the phone, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say, "Hi." "It's me, and there's more trouble over here." Like they've been waiting, going, "Did she call? Did she call?" But there is such fine love and such fine brilliance when it's your time to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, when you get that first tug that goes right to the heart. There's such fine brilliance, because the guy that answered the phone had that fine brilliance. He was tuned in. I don't know what happened that morning. He showed up for, you know, his shift, and he was the right guy for me. Because he listened to me. I'm a nutcase. I'm a broken performer who just knows pop, 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 talk, talk, talk. And this guy listened to me. It was cool. I had a captive audience. That's what I knew, man. So I took him through the blues, and I took him through rock and roll and Glendale and my fine car and what I knew and where I'd been and what, you know, all the famous shoes I'd thrown up on. Bah, 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 bah. And he listened to me. Isn't that love? But periodically, I'd have to take a breath. When I had to take a breath, that's when he made his move. And with all the love in the universe, he said one thing to me. He just said one thing to me. I bah, 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 rock and roll, famous people, big deal, I am, Laurel Canyon, da, 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 da. Take a breath, he said. Sounds like you need a meeting. Now, I didn't really want to go to a meeting. I just was in a talkative mood. My hand had returned and had some coffee. But you know, I'm Nancy, I'm sorry. I'm that girl. And so I thought, I kind of owe this guy for listening to me. So I'll go to his meeting because he listened to me. And I had this big black eye, and I put a lot of makeup on my other eye so my eyes matched. You guys, I had eyes. I mean, I put, you know, I got, anyway, I got the vodka Maybelline tremble going on over here and trying to match it. So like, ooh. And I put a little on this side to make a match. You know, it's like I was crazy and you know, and really sick, but I knew symmetry. And so I kept going back and forth. So I had my big eyes and I put on clothes that could have gone on their own if I'd given them directions and money. And I waltzed down to this gorgeous Sunday morning meeting on Ohio Street in Westwood for any of you who've been to California. And you know how these California AAs do it. They do it just like you do. They dress up and they smile big. I loved all those teeth. How do you say teeth in the first meeting? Well, you know, I didn't know anything about any of this deal. And if I had been wearing a sandwich board that said 12-step call coming, it couldn't have been more obvious. And I thought I was slipping in the door, man. But you guys were so happy to see me. Like, woohoo! Everybody's going, 12-step. I get to work my program. Call my sponsor. 12-step coming. Woohoo! And the flurry of phone numbers fall on you. And it's like, oh, my God. And the gamut of hands, all the pink and white people, they just reminded me of, like, the Brady Bunch. Like, this is the most corny thing I've ever come to my whole life. And I'm feeling like, what are you people doing up? It's noon. How can you be out so early? And you just loved me to death that morning, and I had no idea what that was. I just sat in the back and hated it. Didn't hear one thing, nothing. Didn't hear anything, but I saw things. Don't you love that? I saw two things. One was the woman leading the meeting who was beautiful, and our 12-step call is a visual one too. Believe me, when they tell you that just by going to a meeting you're contributing to that 12-step, it is true. It is true. And this woman who was leading the meeting that day was absolutely beautiful from the middle of her, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because she was doing the deal. She was happy being where she was, doing what she was doing with the people she was doing it with, and she was beautiful. It wasn't the Lancome special. It was real. And you know, I was crazy, but I still have my 10-foot antenna. And 10-foot antenna will tell you sometimes when things are real. And this is a program of recovery that goes right to the heart, works in the heart first, works best in the heart. Works best in the heart. I saw this woman, and that was what brought me back to AA. Because I never met her, I don't know what her name was. But, and oh, the other thing I saw too, cute. I saw the basket of money, the seventh tradition with the dollar bills floating off the edges. I saw that thing disappear into the kitchen, and I thought, I went off and got drunk again, and it was one of those pitiful drunks. I love that Tia Maria thing. That was a funny story. But I got a big bottle. I was going to do better than that. I got a big bottle. Went to one of these gay guys. He was doing drugs across the room from me, and I just popped out. I just had a little bit. And this rude fella sitting across the room from me, he's sniffing and snorting, beeping and honking, doing his drugs. And I'm drinking and talking. He takes a break. He looks at me. He says, "You've really got a drinking problem." Now, that did not do it. But something inside of me at the root changed. And that's something I found out later has to happen. Something inside me suddenly was so, it was like a tsunami of misery going out the other way. I was like sucked out. Everything was gone for a second. And it was an emptiness inside of Planet Nancy. It's that, it's just, I know you know, you've had this. And that was my time. I mean, that's stupid. I mean, I stood up. I left that bottle 2/3 full. A moment of silence. It doesn't get any worse than that. I wandered back into the night, and the next day I thought, you know, maybe I was overreacting. And I had a meeting directory, cunning meeting directory had been placed in my hand. And I, you know, it was June in Los Angeles, which is kind of overcast sometimes. So I thought, well, I don't know if I need a meeting or a tan. And I had no sleeping schedule. I had, every day was an adventure. So I was up actually early. It was 10:30, and there was a 12:30 meeting in Brentwood, and I put on my bikini, and I said, you know, if the sun comes out, I'll go get a tan. But I drove down to this meeting at 10:30, and I did get a little sleepy in the parking lot in my fine car, and I couldn't sleep in my car, and it was Monday. And the church gardener was there on Monday, and they were mowing and clipping, cleaning up the property, and Nancy got sleepy. When Nancy gets sleepy, she sleeps. When Nancy gets hungry, she eats. When Nancy gets, you know, what's Nancy? So I was tired. So I got out of my car, and I stretched out on this newly mowed lawn, and I waited for 12:30 to come around. 12:30 came around, and I'm still fat, sweaty, still have a black eye, split lip, and I'm in a bikini this time. I waltzed upstairs to the meeting, and I filled the doorway like an old Faulkner tableau, you know, Colonel Sartor's. And I'm filling the doorway, fat, sweaty, in a bikini, black eye, split lip, and grass clippings from ear to ear. I did not know. And you looked at me with such love, man. You loved me. Oh my God! What a reception you gave me. It was tremendous. No one wanted me to play any music, but there you were, giving me all those teeth and all that love in your eyes, and you were so happy to see me. And I did not want to get sober, but you were so darn nice. And so I came in on the fellowship. And I came in, and I have not had a drink since that day. It was June 28th, 1976. So for each of us, our recovery unfolds on the same path, but the details are always a little bit different. And then there's that story truth and the happening truth. And the story truth is what I cling to, because I have so much faith now, based not only on knowing how much I survived when I was crazy, but how much God gave me once I got here and the ways that it came. And it always comes through the people. The love is in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I can't just depend on the rooms, because like the book says, these are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. It's not, these are the meetings we go to that are suggested as a program. These are the pills we take that are the program of recovery. These are the people we hang around with, the jobs that we do, the steps of the program of recovery, but I came to them grudgingly. I did not think there was really anything wrong with me. I came here a big victim. And it's taken many, many, many years and many sweet confidences, given and receiving, to understand how much I volunteered for. To understand what alcoholism is, that it's not over, that I have it now. And this is where I planted my feet finally one day. Well, I had to plant my feet in here. They said, don't have reservations. Don't have reservations. If you have a reservation, you will collect that reservation. Don't have reservations. And so life has been really rich these last almost 32 years with you in this design for living. But in the beginning, it was resistance, resistance, resistance. No, not me. I can't do it. No, not me. God hates me. I killed my dad. No, not me. My mom, I hurt everybody. No, not me. I walked away. I broke the band. No, not me. All that craziness. But God is amazing. And the sponsorship has been talked about this weekend. How important that is, sponsorship and guidance and love. And I found a home group, but home group was also the place where you go no matter what, where they get to know you no matter what, and where you have a job. And I got a little crazy in the beginning. Actually, you know, I'll tell you something. The first step I really worked was the 12th step. Man, I love that. You know why? Because I'm a performer. I like to stand out and do something and move it around and get somebody's attention. And I love running up to newcomers. The first time I did it, I had 82 days. I've been going to meetings for 81 days. For 81 days, if it wasn't about me, I didn't hear it. For 81 days, I didn't even see any other newcomers. I always thought I was the only one. And you said I was the lifeblood of the program. I thought, well, they recognize genius. And as soon as I'm able to talk and stuff, I can help you guys because you were so corny. So I'm really going to help you. And but I had 82 days, and I was standing in front of the old Radford, 4343 Radford, in Studio City, which is a famous place in Los Angeles. It's no longer there, but it was there then. And I stood out front of that new meeting when it had ended. It was like September, and it was just a typical day. And this wash of love started to be in me. I didn't even know it was love. It was freedom from the bondage of self. I was saying that dumb third step prayer, but I didn't know that was going to happen. I didn't really believe. And yet, they told me mechanical prayers work too. They set the bar really low around here if you're having God problems like I had. Bill Wilson did that deliberately, and I'm so grateful. The bar is really low. You don't have to do that much at first. So I was standing in front of this meeting. I had this wash of freedom from something. I didn't know what it was, and then my eyes fell on her. She was standing 20 feet in front of me, and she was hating the deal. You know, just hating the deal. Hair was plastered to her cheeks. She was sweating. Her jaw was clenched, old T-shirt on. And I loved her. Man, and my feet took off, and I said those horrible words, all my teeth. Hi. I'm so grateful to be sober, capital letters, grateful to be sober. Are you new? And it's like, that is so hot. Doing that to newcomers is so hot. They just hate you. And yet, we have so much joy in our experience because we know, newcomer, if you're here, whatever it is, I know that you will find great joy in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're willing to do the work. I know that. And so when I see a new person, I love, love, love on them like crazy. So that was the first thing. I got in that toss. I was like, man, look at that. I just, aren't I wonderful? What a wonderful newcomer. And I got my first sponsee when I was 6 months sober. And she made a fool of me. She was a pillhead. And actually, I ran a lot of errands for her. But I read in the book, you know, just enough to hold my own in a book study. I didn't want to get too serious about this thing, but and I'd stay ahead of her a little bit. So that didn't work out. And then 1 month later, another woman came up to me and asked me to be her sponsor. And I had 7 months. And I said, well, yes, of course. And what step are you on? Okay. And you know what? I gave her a 30-year chip about a year and a half ago. That applause is not for me, guys. That's for this Design for Living, because that's what Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob did. They only had a few minutes together, and they got busy. And Mary Ellen and I got busy. We got busy on these steps. We got busy running around. We got busy in the kitchen. We started going to other meetings. We started looking for women to help. We got busy with this program of love and service and forgiveness, as it turns out. Because you get a little time around here, you're going to get some resentments. They used to say, if you can get along in AA, you'll get along anywhere. We are such big fighters. Ever thus, though, I'll tell you, I love the history. I turned into a history nut when I was 24 years sober. I really started reading the literature, and I just fell more and more deeply into this whole of love for Alcoholics Anonymous. This program is an amazing, the developments, how we got together, it just gives me chills. And I read this stuff, and I just love it. And in the early days, they used to argue about everything. You know, so Bill and Bob, they finally got another drunk. They got Bill D and all this thing. Guys, they start fighting about everything. The first thing they fought about, you know what they fought about first, was they didn't want to move out of their houses. They didn't want to get away from their kitchen parlors. And the coffee pot, they said, this'll wreck AA. We can't meet in churches. This'll wreck AA, right? Fight. 5 years of writing the book, they're fighting. There's a faction that said, this book will wreck AA. If there's a book, AA won't last. There are still some people against the book, but never mind. But I love reading this history stuff. I started reading it when I was 24, but I got ahead of myself. I don't remember when I started. Sorry. Okay. I started working the program from the outside in because I was too afraid to go in, and it took a long time. And I finally did write that inventory. I finally did begin to pray to a God that I didn't believe anymore was going to hurt me. And I began to see God through you guys. It was through the laughter, too. I think the laughter is God's music, don't you? Isn't that funny how we laugh at these big tragedies we bring in here? Oh, ho, ho, ho. Oh, did you make your bed? Oh, you know. Somehow you keep telling the story because you think the old timer didn't hear the story. They're pretty old. Do I have to tell this again? Oh, did you make your bed? And you get better. I got to my inventory, and I had a lap full of misery in my sponsor's house, all these papers. And it wasn't a book inventory. It was the best inventory I did in that moment. And, you know, as I drove to her house to share this fifth step, I was the great I am was back. And I said, well, I've been to the priest. Well, I've been to the psychiatrist. I can do this. This is no big deal. But no, that was not what God wanted. And when I got into her home, something was in her home, one alcoholic helping another. And there was grace there. The sun was streaming through the French windows, and the steam was rising off the teacups, and the cats were stretched out on the Indian rug, and I had this pain in my lap, all this paper that I had written. And all of a sudden, the big great I am in the car was gone, and the humility and the moment, and I couldn't speak. So she leaned forward gently, finally, and said, "It's better out loud." And it was, and I cried, and I found things that I did not know, that I did not see in all those years. And I started to undo the knot and bring it out into the sunlight, and it was a lot of illusions, a lot of bold, bad ideas. It was wrong. It was wrong. And I went back. I've never written about that again. I've done lots of inventories because writing is a road to freedom for many of us. Uncover, discover, discard. The old man said years ago, uncover, discover, discard. So then I went on, and I had to make amends, and amends were very tough in the music business. I didn't know how to do that, but you showed me a way. You showed me how to do everything, absolutely everything. You showed me how to act and how to eat and how to clean the house and how to wear a dress. I was 5 years sober before I could really wear a dress, and you taught me how to speak again. You know, I came in here speaking the language of cool, which is four words, and three of them are wow, one syllable, and you taught me to speak again. You taught me in coffee shops, and you taught me from the lectern, And you taught me, and I listened to you having conversations with each other. I remember sitting, I was squashed in the back of my sponsor's little bug, Volkswagen bug, as we pulled away from the curb from an AA party. Oh my God, an AA party. What an event to go to when you're new. Jeez. People do not kick back in AA parties, man. And eating, and oh my God. And they stuffed me in the back of this little orange Volkswagen bug, and she had a girlfriend with her who was sober for a while, and they looked at each other and they said, boy, wasn't that a good time? And I sat in the back and thought, oh, so that's a good time. I remember I got married for a little while, saw him. He had blue eyes. We went roller skating, and the next day we moved in together. Yeah. We moved to Laguna Beach, and he moved out and went away, and all the rock and roll money was gone, and I started cleaning houses. I was 5 years sober, but that's how I learned how to work. I learned to be responsible. People gave me keys to their houses. You remember Robin Hood? And so I was working, and I was doing a good job, and I was living in a little room, but you know, I didn't really make enough money because I wasn't really a good house cleaner. I was responsible for being there, and I didn't steal anything, but I wasn't very good. So, anyway. I was also 5 years sober, and I had a lot of opinions. You know, at five, do you get your opinions back? I got mine back. Boy, I had a lot to say about everything going on in the world. Listened to a lot of talk radio and talk back. Cleaning houses, talking back. Not making enough money. So I finally decided to go back to college for money. Periodically, I used to go to college to take typing. Yeah. Once I went to cut hair, I tried to go to beauty school. Got everything. Bought all the equipment, all the tools and scissors and the white shoes and the white uniform and the bag and the Gloria head, the thing that you want. But I couldn't even part the hair on my Gloria head. That lasted 2 weeks. I'm a singer. I'm a dancer. I'm a writer. You know, I'm an artist. And so I'm not a very good house cleaner. So I went back to school and I was ready. You had taught me how to be teachable, how to ask questions, and some humility, which is so vital for me. I so much need the humility that's embedded in our program, that's embedded in our design for living, and that was working. And I knew now I was had learned to go to school, and I went to school, and I was crazy about school. Oh my God! Look at the world, God! Look at the world. Took astronomy and ran back to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach. I said, astronomy, you guys, we're made of pieces of stars. We're pieces of stars, and everybody said, yes, very nice. Make the coffee. You know? But you went to school with me. I got into trouble with quantum physics. And there was a guy there who explained quantum physics to me. And another guy there, we talked about Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales. And all of a sudden, I've got a plan, and I can do something. And my first tutee I tutored in the writing center was a nun from Vietnam. She was a hot shot in Vietnam, but she couldn't get her credits out. She had a big forehead, all that wisdom in there. She was some kind of physicist or something. And she sat across the table from me in the writing center, and she was starting over too, her and I. And I had something for her because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could help her. I could teach her to write. And so we got started. And I thought, maybe I could be a teacher. Maybe I can do something. You know, and I began to let go of that singer stuff and let go of that music stuff. And I was working from my heart. And so I became, in 1989, I started teaching college English. And thank you. And I've been doing it for 20 years, and I became an assistant professor last year. But you know, there's that, you know how we are. Everything I let go of has claw marks in it. There's still that music thing, man. That's, you know, and all these people are coming back. Hey, man, you know, hey, I can do it. And you're just loving me through all of this. And I got the band back together, moved back to Los Angeles, and my mother died before then, and she died knowing I was going to be all right because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you walked through that with me. And I said, well, I'm going to move back to LA and I'm going to get that band together and I'm going to come back and I'm going to make some money so I can retire and be an old person and just go to meetings. And I wanted to make a fortune. And so I worked so hard. I'm smart. I can write. I started writing at Glendale College, just writing a story, writing a script, and I make a plan and I find these old guys. Now almost everybody's died. Sweetwater. But I find these old guys in their garage. I pull them out. There's two of them still alive. I say, come on, we're going to make a comeback. We find some more musicians that prop them up. The great I am. Now I'm 20 years sober. I can do this. I get this all together. I make all this happen. I get these guys. You know, and the phone rings, and one of Cliff R's babies in Oceanside, they're having the San Diego International Convention, and Cliff R's baby's in charge of entertainment. He says, hey, Nancy, how would you like the new Sweetwater to play at the international convention? And I cover the phone. I say, hey, guys, how would you like our first gig to be for 100,000 people? And they're earth people. They don't get anything. They have that face-saving thing, so they like go, yeah, it's okay. Everybody joins a gym. They go on diets. They get tie-dye shirts. And we start running around, and we go down to the San Diego International Convention. And I'm so obsessed with my plan and wanting to have a few $100,000 in the bank so that all I have to do is go to AA meetings. And now I can, and I won't have to teach anymore. And no, people don't appreciate me anyway. And so I'm working on this and trying to get this deal together. And there you were. And that we set up. Actually, we missed 100,000 people. They put us in a park. And there was about 40 people who heard the music over the water. So that was okay. That was the best day, because there you were. And I looked across at my old bandmates, and I was able to give them that. Because they had to go back to see the circle, too. And there was a, you know, they made a fuss about us in that the 30-year anniversary of Woodstock. And the band played a little bit, but you know what? We're not the only ones. We're not the only ones that live with tragedies and aches and heartaches. But if they're normal people, they have different ways of dealing with it. And they didn't want to do what I wanted to do. They didn't see it my way. And so it didn't work out. And a good thing I still have my teaching job, you know. And as I go back in and I learn to teach, I thought, well, my God doesn't want another rock star. Guess I have to teach. And I'm a different kind of teacher, because they don't know it, but we have meetings. Classes, you have to, commitments, and everybody shares. And they don't know it's a meeting because I'm the big book in there. I have to be. I have to practice the principles in all my affairs. And they don't know that. And you know what I've noticed in the last couple of years? They think they could talk to me. I want to get out there and make phone calls and go to a meeting. And they say, Ms. Nevins, can I talk to you? And I've had this happen a lot now. They want to tell me stuff. And I can't tell you what they tell me. But they think they can. That's the great I am. That's that girl that babbled into the central office guy, hey, you know, let me tell you what, and they want to talk to me. I got a teaching award a couple months ago. God is putting all these smiles into my life, into our lives. I'm also becoming a biker. Yeah, on the motorcycle and all that. Got a helmet, and we'll see what happens. But I get to grow and change in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to say that all the time. I used to say, I am Nancy, I'm a growing and changing alcoholic. And I read an article in the Grapevine that says, no, you don't need all that. Sometimes it puts a newcomer off to hear all that. You know, they think they've got to be grateful. You don't have to be grateful. You can be here and be ungrateful. You don't have to be growing. I hope you are, but you don't have to. So I stopped saying that. I'm an alcoholic, just like you. But I do know what it's like to feel like you've just landed on the moon when you get here. And sometimes that happens when you move away from the center of your program a little bit, and that old ego has come back, and somehow there's something you got to prove somewhere. There's something you can't let go of, and you feel like you're on the moon. And what are they talking about? This meeting is going on too long. And how come that guy's doing that? You know, you're off center again. You feel like you've lost God. And I've been there. And if there are new people here right now, If there's a new person on the end of this CD or on the end of this cassette, I want to share something with you that I just love. And it's a poem. It's a poem that they left on the moon in 1971 for future space explorers. Like maybe they would get there and wonder, you know, where's God? How could you miss God if you were standing on the moon? But never mind. This poem is about God, and it says, "Do you need me?" That's the title of it. That's the first line. It's a question. Do you need me? I am there. You cannot see me, but I am the light you see by. You cannot hear me, but I speak through your voice. I am the love you can cling to. I am your assurance. I am your peace. I am one with you. And you told me that God was sitting on either side of me in an AA meeting. And I believed that. And whenever I needed help, it came through the voices of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was a kid, I wasn't born bad. I was born covered in stars. Babies are covered in stars, and little girls are covered in stars. And girls in the drive-in are starting to lose their stars. And that drinking life takes over, starts taking away the stars one at a time. And then we come in here. Stars are gone. And year in and year out, the stars get added back on. And pretty soon, you're bright again. The stars are back. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous can do for the alcoholic who still suffers, who really wants it. Newcomer, we love you so much. You just cannot leave until you find out why. Thank you. All right.